From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're ending 2019 with a series of interviews featuring staff picks from the decade. Today,
help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Our 2016 interview with Carrie Fisher after the publication of her memoir about making the first Star Wars movie. We also talked about her complicated relationship with her mother, Debbie Reynolds. Fisher died the month after our interview was recorded. Reynolds died the day after Fisher. Also, excerpts of two interviews with Meryl Streep about her singing and her ability to do accents, like Margaret Thatcher's in Iron Lady.
She had a very particular way of emphasizing, bringing out a word that you didn't normally think was the most important word in the sentence. Do you know what I mean?
That's on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the decade with a holiday week series of interviews featuring staff picks from the decade. We begin with Meryl Streep, who we've been lucky enough to have on our show twice. Today, excerpts from both interviews. She's widely acknowledged as one of our greatest actors. Here's just a few of her awards. 3 Oscars for Iron Lady, Sophie's Choice, and Kramer vs. Kramer. 5 Golden Globes, including for Julie and Julia, The Devil Wears Prada, and Adaptation. She also won the Globe Cecil B. DeMille Award. She won 4 Primetime Emmys. I could go on. This year, she co-starred in the HBO series Big Little Lies, and she's now in Greta Gerwig's adaptation of Little Women in the role of Aunt March. When we spoke in February 2012, her film Iron Lady was about to open, in which she portrayed Margaret Thatcher, the former British Prime Minister. Here's an excerpt of her Oscar-winning performance as Thatcher.
The Right Honourable Gentleman knows very well that we had no choice but to close the school. Because his union paymasters have called a strike deliberately to cripple our economy. Teachers cannot teach when there is no heating, no lighting in their classrooms. And I ask the Right Honourable Gentleman, whose fault is that?
Methinks the Right Honourable Lady doth screech too much. And if she wants us to take her seriously, she must learn to calm down.
If the Right Honourable Gentleman could perhaps attend more closely to what I am saying, rather than how I am saying it, he may receive a valuable education in spite of himself.
Margaret Thatcher later took voice lessons from a drama coach to help her sound more authoritative. Here's Streep as Thatcher after those lessons, addressing Parliament about the war in the Falklands.
We were faced with an act of unprovoked aggression, and we responded, as we have responded in times past, with unity, strength, and courage. Sure in the knowledge that though much is sacrificed, in the end, right will prevail over wrong.
Meryl Streep, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Terry. I'm a huge fan.
Oh, wow. Thank you. So we just heard you before and after Margaret Thatcher has voice lessons to teach her authority and power so that she can speak more powerfully to the Parliament. So can you talk a little bit about what you think she learned with those vocal lessons and how you transformed your voice as her after she really learned her way around as a public figure and had the advantage of those voice lessons?
Well, I think that voice lessons really just bring out a voice that you already possess. So she already had whatever the sort of stentorian tones that she acquired over time. They were all lying in wait there and within her arsenal. And she'd also had elocution in her high school, the equivalent of high school, in Grantham. She had changed her way of speaking. Her accent from Grantham had disappeared by the time she went to Oxford to study chemistry. And she had decided on a sort of a plummy kind of aspirant, upper-middle-class voice. And so what the voice coach did was enabled her to expand her breath, deepen her voice, bring it to a place where men could listen to it in its most emphatic tones.
So how did you change your voice for the before and after, for the more confident and experienced Margaret Thatcher versus the early Margaret Thatcher?
Well, I had evidence of both voices, you know, from the public record, so I could listen to them. And it's sort of my fun to sing along with records and imitate people that are on the telephone. that have different ways of speaking. I mean, I pick things up like that. So it's not a thing that's a struggle. It's work, but it's not a struggle. It's fun. And she had a very particular way of emphasizing points and making her point. And that had to do with bringing out a word that you didn't normally think was the most important word in the sentence. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And she also had a sort of a way, like a railroad train, of going, taking a breath and starting quite quietly and making a point in a way that you don't really know that this point is going to be made through several examples, and there will not be a break in the speaking voice at any point. And you, if you think you're going to interrupt, you're really not going to have the opportunity, because she's just got capacity. It's just really stunning as I looked at interviews.
So you need a lot of breath to keep talking like that. Did you have it?
I've just been talking like that. yeah, I did need a lot of breath. I needed much more breath than I have after all my expensive drama school training. I couldn't keep up with her.
I think it's interesting that when you're doing the voice of a real person, or I suppose if you're learning an accent too, you think of it as singing along with a record. So is that what you do, like you play Margaret Thatcher giving a speech and you do the equivalent of singing along with it? You give the speech as you're listening to it.
I say that because that's my way in mm-hmm. the very beginning, how to enter it. Very quickly in the process, I don't think about voice being separate from the way you hold your head, or the way you sit, or the way you dress, or the way you put on lipstick. It's all a piece of a person, and it's all driven by conviction. In other characters, it's driven by insecurity, or it's driven by fear. Or there's always a driver, and all the physical manifestations, you need your way in. So, yeah. When I was a kid, when I was 16, 17, I'd come home from high school, and my dad collected all of Barbra Streisand's records, and she was very young then. I think she probably had 3 records out, and she was 21, and we had them all. And I knew every single song, every breath, every elision, every swell, and I sang along to it, but it for me, it was a way to get out the feeling of the song, and also to get out the feelings that, you know, royal in high school, to express something that I had no other way of expressing. And, of course, now I'm rich and famous, and I met Barbra Streisand, and I told her that she was nonplussed. She was just... We can't know what we mean to each other. You know, artists, you can't know that.
You know, I hear a certain similarity between your voice in The Iron Lady as Margaret Thatcher and your voice in Julie and Julia as Julia Child. It almost strikes me as if, and I never thought about this till hearing you in both those films, that if Margaret Thatcher kind of drank too much and started being like surprised and delighted about how her like food concoction was behaving, that she might sound like Julia Child. What do you think?
Well, they had a similar flutiness in, especially in the younger Julia Child had a flutiness.
Yeah, you
know, which is, and it's also part of her class, her the way that there are women of that time. And of that class, we don't like to talk about that in America, but there are classes in America. And she was of a class of women who were wealthy, privately educated, went to Smith, moved in that sort of circle.
Let me play a little bit of you as Julia Child in Julie and Julia. And this is a scene when you're on TV, early in your TV career, and you're making some kind of like mashed potato pancake concoction that you're about to flip, and it
doesn't go well.
Doesn't go well. It kind of splatters in the air, and half of it lands on the stove instead of in the pan. So let's hear a little bit of that. And this scene alternates with you on TV and with Julie watching you on TV.
Amy Adams, yeah.
Yeah, Amy Adams is Julie.
I'm going to try to flip this thing over now, which is a rather daring thing to do.
She changed everything. Before her, it was frozen food and can openers and marshmallows.
Don't knock marshmallows.
Give it a try. When you flip anything, you've just got to have the courage of your convictions, especially if it's a loose sort of mass, like, oh, that didn't go very well. But you see, when I flipped it, I didn't have the
She's
courage.
She's so adorable.
I needed to the way I should have. But you can always put it together. And you're alone in the kitchen. Who's to see?
But pearls. The woman is wearing pearls in the kitchen.
You've just got to practice, like the piano. I'm Julia Child. Bon appetit.
You know, I love that because you talk about studying someone's voice as if it's music, and she has such a musical voice.
And she does. And she has no breath.
Yeah,
absolutely
not. Exactly. It sounds like she's been running up a hill.
She always sounds like that. I feel like that when I'm in the kitchen, don't you? Well, I'm not a very good cook.
Me neither, honestly. I believe that's
why
delis exist, so that I don't have to cook.
Well, I got better after this, and my entire family really did appreciate it. Usually they're resentful of movies that I go off and make, but this one had a bonus attached.
You know, I compared her voice and Thatcher's voice before, but breath-wise, they're the opposite, because she's almost like gasping for air, and Thatcher has this like endlessly long breath.
Well, she's so alive, Julia Child, and Margaret is so designed. She's so intent upon making her point. That's the most important thing, is that she win the argument. And there is nothing that stands in the way of that train, you know. But Julia's just alive in front of you. That's part of why people loved her. They lived it with her. They breathed it with her. And the mistakes were all part of it. But she was adept, too, at what she was doing. Incredibly adept.
We're listening to my 2012 interview with Meryl Streep. We'll hear more of the interview after a break as we continue our series of staff picks from the decade. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my 2012 interview with Meryl Streep. Okay, so here's a story I read, which I assume is true, but you can tell me if it actually happened, that for the 1976 Dino De Laurentiis remake of King Kong, you auditioned for Dino De Laurentiis and his son,
yes,
who were Italian.
Yes.
And Dino De Laurentiis said in Italian, what did he say?
Che brutta. Perché me, I don't know. I can't speak Italian anymore because I'm so old and forgetful. But he said something like, but this is so ugly. Why do you bring me this?
This being you.
Yes, yeah. I'm sitting in front of him opposite the desk. He's smiling. He looks impeccable. He has everything beautiful. And his son was very kind. His son said, because his son had seen me in something. And he said, no, you know, Dad, she's a wonderful actress. And because I'd studied a year of Italian at Vassar, I could understand what they were saying. And I said, you know, mi dispiace molto, that I'm very sorry that I'm not as beautiful as I should be. But, you know, this is it. This is what you get, sort of. And I left. I mean, I was very upset. I didn't show it. Yes, it's a true story.
So, a very interesting story, because you're being told early in your career, basically, that you're not beautiful.
Yeah.
You're not qualified. Your face is not qualified for this role. And you're also...
Face and body, I believe.
And body. But then you're also making the decision to let them know that you understand what they said. They were intentionally speaking in Italian so that you wouldn't understand them.
Right.
But you did understand them. You let them know you understood them. And
because they did. They think actresses are stupid. That was the other thing. That, I mean, not they, because I don't think his son was that way. His son was my champion. I mean, he was the reason I was in the office. But the dad, he wasn't being mean to me. He was just speaking to his son in Italian. But he had no idea that I would understand, because they think Americans are stupid too. So,
did you worry that you were basically? I mean, you hadn't been in any movies yet. So, did you worry that word would spread about you that you were spoke back to directors?
Ass?
Yeah, that you were a real pain and that you were that you were a problem. So, like, avoid her.
I am a pain in the ass. How can I hide it? I mean, that is the package, you know. But I was not probably suited to that role either. I mean, that was the truth.
How much did you want it?
Not much.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I did want a break, but I didn't think I would be good in it, honestly. I didn't. It represented something that, I don't know, I wasn't drawn to. So I suppose it was easier to be obstreperous in the meeting because of that. If it was an audition for Sophie's Choice and Helen Bakula had said something like that, I maybe would have swallowed it because I wanted it so badly.
You gave a terrific commencement address at Barnard in 2010. And one of the things you talked about was that the hardest thing in the world is to persuade a straight male audience to identify with a woman character. It's easier for women because we were brought up identifying with male characters in literature. It's hard for straight boys to identify with Juliet or Wendy in Peter Pan, whereas girls identify with Romeo and with Peter Pan. What led you to that conclusion?
What led me to that was I watch movies, and I don't care who is the protagonist. I feel what that guy is feeling. You know, if it's Tom Cruise leaping over a building, I want to make it, you know? And I'm going to, yes, I made it. And, so I get that. And I've grown up, well, partly because there weren't great girls' literature, Nancy Drew maybe, but there weren't things. So there was Huck Finn and Spinning Marty. The boys' characters were interesting, and you live through them when you're watching it. You know, you're not aware of it, but you're following the action of the film through the body of the protagonist. You know, you feel what he feels when he jumps, when he leaps, when he wins, when he loses. But it became obvious to me that men don't live through the female characters.
Do you think that women have that kind of double consciousness? And men, you think, like boys,
I think it's,
don't make
it has
that
to
leap.
Do with,
yeah.
Well, it has to do with very deep things, you know, because it might be that imagining yourself as a girl is a diminishment. But it is something that when I made The Devil Wears Prada, it was the first time in my life, 30 years of making movies, that a man came up and said, I know how you felt. I know how you feel. I have a job like that.
It's the first time?
First time. And they say lots of things. I think this is what I was trying to say in that speech. It's a very hard point to make because I guess it's hard to wrap your head around it. But for men, the favorite character that I've ever played is Linda in The Deer Hunter. Without question, of the heterosexual men that I've spoken to over the years, that's usually, they say, you know, my favorite thing you've ever done was Linda or Sophie. And they were a particular kind of very feminine, recessive kind of personality. They fell in love with her, but they didn't feel the story through her body. And it took to the Devil Wears Prada to play someone tough, who had to make hard decisions, who was running an organization, and sometimes that takes making tough decisions for a certain kind of man to empathize. That's the word, empathize. Feel the story through her. And that's the first time anybody has ever said that they felt that way.
That's really interesting. Yeah, what do women tell you their favorite role is?
Oh, they love everything.
Okay.
They really do. I mean, it's a range of stuff.
So do you like seeing yourself on screen, or is that an uncomfortable experience?
I don't dislike it. I don't, you know, pop in the CD, the DVD.
Let's look at that again.
Yeah. But I do think when, you know, sometimes the scrolling through the TV and there's something on, and I look at it and I think, oh, my God, I thought I was fat. What is my problem? You know, when I was younger, I spent way too much time thinking about that. So stupid.
My interview with Meryl Streep was recorded in 2012. After a short break, we'll hear an excerpt of my 2016 interview with her in which we talked about her singing. And we'll hear an excerpt of my interview with Carrie Fisher recorded in 2016, 1 month before her death, as we continue our interview series of staff picks from the decade. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Total Wine & More, where in-store teams can recommend a bottle of wine, spirit, or beer for any occasion. Shoppers can explore more than 8,000 wines, 2,500 beers, and 3,000 spirits. More at totalwine.com. And from the Union of Concerned Scientists, putting rigorous, independent science to work for a healthy planet and a safer world. More at ucsusa.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As part of our Staff Picks from the Decade series, we're going to hear an excerpt of our second interview with Meryl Streep, recorded in 2016 after the release of her movie Florence Foster Jenkins, in which she portrayed a wildly off-key, screechy singer. In that film, Streep was convincing as a committed but terrible singer, but Streep sang well for real in other films, including Postcards from the Edge, Mamma Mia, and Into the Woods. So you were in the screen adaptation of the Stephen Sondheim musical Into the Woods, and you played the witch. And the story in this is basically it's a mashup of several fairy tales, including Red Riding Hood, Rapunzel, Cinderella, Jack and the Beanstalk. And you play a witch, a beautiful woman who, because of a spell, was turned into a witch and so on. And this is a song that you sing in it. And it's a very Sondheim song in the sense that the intervals are odd in a way that Sondheim intervals are unusual. The syncopations are unusual in his unusual way. So it takes a lot of talent to sing this. So here's Meryl Streep
from the soundtrack of the Stephen Sondheim musical, Into the Woods.
It's the last midnight. It's the last wish. It's the soon it will be boom, squish. Told a little lie, stole a little gold, broke a little vow. Did you? Had to get your prince, had to get your cow, had to get your wish, doesn't matter how. Anyway, it doesn't matter now. It's the last midnight, it's the boom. Splat! Nothing but a vast midnight. Everybody smash! Splat! Nothing we can do. Not exactly true. We could always give her the boy. No, of course, what really matters is the blame. Someone you can blame. Fine, if that's the thing you enjoy, placing the blame. If that's the aim, give me the blame. Just give me the boy!
No.
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 You're so nice. You're not good. You're not
Meryl Streep from the soundtrack of the Stephen Sondheim musical, Into the Woods. Did Stephen Sondheim work with you at all on that?
A little bit. What he did was he wrote me a new song that we recorded but was taken out of the movie because of length, but he played it for me in his apartment and sang it to me. I mean, it's one of the great, most cherished memories of my life is just that little hallowed afternoon where he played this magical thing for me. And it. Mm-hmm. And I think he's our great composer, you know, for the musical theater. So
yes,
it was like, you know, come on, I could die now.
Do you know who you are singing as yourself? Because I've only seen you sing in character. And
yes,
when
in
you're
character.
When you're in like a rock musical, you know, Ricky and the Flash, and in Postcards from the Edge, you're singing more, I don't know, but somewhere between like, well, there's a country and western song, and then there's a more, you know.
Oh, yeah, and Postcards, yeah.
So like, I don't know, I don't have a sense of like, if I said, and tonight, Meryl Streep in concert. I don't know what you'd sing or how you'd sound.
Well, it would be a varied show. I don't know. I don't really... I don't.
Is that a warm-up
really,
exercise?
Yes, it's like... well, one Christmas, I remember when I was 12, my mother decided to, in front of the whole family, the gathered family, including my formidable grandmother, Mamie, she said, Meryl sang O Holy Night in French, and Meryl, sing it now. And I have never, if I ever have to play a person who is overcome with fear and terror, I go back to that moment because I was just, I hadn't had any trouble singing in the Christmas concert, but standing in the living room in front of my whole family, all my, you know, annoying brothers and my cousins and everybody looking at me, I just went crazy. I just was like shaking. I remember everything shaking. And I thought, I don't like this feeling. I think I'm not a natural performer. I think I'm an actor.
Well, getting back to music, I want to play something else. And this is from Postcards from the Edge, which was made in 1990, directed by the now late Mike Nichols, based on a book by...
Carrie Fisher,
yes. And it's kind of biographical. So you've been in rehab. You're kind of trying to figure out your life. In this, your character, and your mother, who is modeled on Carrie Fisher's mother, Debbie Reynolds, is a singer and performer who was big in musicals in the 50s and 60s. You've been living with her. There's a party at her place, and you're asked to sing.
It's funny that I spoke about that moment in my grandmother's house because it was very similar. Shirley MacLaine plays my mother. She makes me do this, and I've just gotten out of rehab. And my character is very tender and raw, and she kind of more or less forces me to get up in front of all these people and sing. So it's very deflected and sort of a lot of excuses built into singing something that actually means something. And still, it's almost this little tiny voice from somewhere deep inside. And then her mother gets up and sings Stephen Sondheim's I'm Still Here.
That's right.
And throws her legs up on the piano and the red sequin dress. And it just blows her daughter out of the water once again.
I really like your performance in that you've been living with her. There's a party at her place and you're asked to sing. So you go up to, I forget if it's a guitarist or pianist, and you start working it out with him. And the song is You Don't Know Me. So here is Meryl Streep from Postcards from the Edge.
You know that? Okay. You give your hand to me, that Ray Charles tune, and then you say hello.
Yeah. Keep going.
And I can hardly speak, hardly sing. My heart is beating so, and anyone can tell that you think you know me well.
Sweet song.
Well, you don't know me. No, you don't know. Kiss your lips, longs to hold you tight to you. I'm just a friend, and that's all that I've ever been. But you don't know me.
You don't know the bridge.
That's Meryl Streep singing in the film Postcards from the Edge. Well, Meryl Streep, I really regret that we're out of time. It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Meryl Streep, recorded in 2016. The film Postcards from the Edge, starring Streep, was written by Carrie Fisher, who adapted it from her novel. After a short break, we'll hear my 2016 interview with Fisher, recorded after the publication of her memoir about making the first Star Wars film, as we continue our interview series of staff picks from the decade. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, committed to reimagining banking, offering savings and checking accounts that can be opened from anywhere. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. And from the YMCA, a nonprofit working to fill gaps and bridge divides in 10,000 U.S. communities. Details about the impact of donations are available at ymca.net/giving. The Y. For a better us.
This is Fresh Air. Next up in our interview series of staff picks from the decade is our 2016 interview with Carrie Fisher. I'm sure a lot of Star Wars fans are thinking about her now that the final episode of the Skywalker saga is in theaters. Carrie Fisher became known around the world as Princess Leia. She was in the first three Star Wars films, as well as The Force Awakens in 2015 and The Last Jedi in 2017. She appears through archival footage in the new film, The Rise of Skywalker. Fisher was also the author of the memoir, Wishful Drinking, and the novel, Postcards from the Edge, which she adapted into a film, starring Meryl Streep.
Fisher was the daughter of celebrities, singer Eddie Fisher and actor and singer Debbie Reynolds, who starred in Singin' in the Rain. My interview with Carrie Fisher was recorded in November 2016. She died 1 month later. The day after her death, her mother died. When we spoke, Fisher had just published a memoir called The Princess Diarist about making the first Star Wars film. The book included excerpts from the diary she wrote while shooting the film when she was having a secret affair with her co-star Harrison Ford. Carrie Fisher, welcome back to Fresh Air. So how did you find your Star Wars diary? I mean, had you forgotten that you wrote it?
I forgot that I wrote it, and I was making my bedroom bigger. And so there was all these boxes of writing underneath the floorboards. And I found it among all this other stuff. And I remembered when I saw it.
So what most surprised you that you'd forgotten you'd experienced, but you'd had written about in your journal?
That I was so insecure.
Oh, yeah, that surprised me, too. It seems like you really needed other people to tell you who you were because you didn't know.
No, I know. At least I knew that. At least I was aware that I didn't know who I was. So that was something, but it was sad to me.
As you've pointed out, in Star Wars, you were the only girl in an all-boy fantasy. When did you start realizing that you were part of boys' sex fantasies?
Not until way later, and I'm very glad of that. Like about, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago, some guy said to me, I thought about you every day from when I was 12 to when I was 22. And I said, every day? And he said, well, 4 times a day. And, you know, what do you say to that? Thank you?
What do you say to that?
Then I started becoming aware of it in an uncomfortable way.
So was it a very boys kind of set when you were making the film?
Yeah. It's mostly, crews are still mostly men. I mean, I like that they have continuity girl. So they don't call her continuity woman. It's a continuity girl, and they're women in makeup and hair and wardrobe, but not in camera, not in sound, you know, and not in special effects. It's all men.
Did that add to your feeling of insecurity?
I think I sort of felt isolated. You know, I didn't really have anyone. I didn't confide in men. Well, I didn't confide in anyone then.
As opposed to oversharing like you do now.
Yes, that's right. I made up for it.
So what's really made news from your book is your affair with Harrison Ford when you were making Star Wars. He was in his mid-30s and married. You were 19. Did you tell him you were going to write about it before you actually published the book?
Oh, yeah.
I'm really relieved to hear that.
You're relieved?
I'm relieved, yeah.
Oh, no, I wouldn't have ambushed him like that. But it's still, no matter if I told him or not, it probably feels like an ambush. It feels like an ambush to me. I'm the one that wrote it.
Did you tell him or did you ask him for permission?
No, I said I found the journals that I kept during the first movie and I'm probably going to publish them. And he just sort of raised his finger and said, lawyer. And then I said, no, I won't, you know, write anything that you don't want. I mean, I'll show it to you before and you can take anything out that you want taken out. I don't want to, you know, make you uncomfortable, which I, of course, have. Unduly uncomfortable.
So he read it before it was published, and did he ask for any changes?
I sent it to him, and I never heard back, so I can't imagine that he was comfortable with everything that was in it. But it's not like it's negative about him. It's just a personal story that's been a secret for a long time. And I'm sure he would have stopped me if he could have.
But it sounds like you gave him that opportunity.
Well, I gave him the opportunity to take out anything he didn't like.
Right, but not to stop it, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think it's that revealing, or it's certainly not offensive. It's not unkind about him. It's flattering. I mean, the way people are reacting to it is funny to me, too. I'd do him at 73.
So it sounds like, you know, reading the book, that you had a kind of love-hate relationship with your identity as Princess Leia. It made you a star. It's an iconic role. But there's things you haven't liked about being Princess Leia in the eyes of the world. What's the downside?
No, I actually don't think there is that much of a downside. The downside is the hair. The downside is the hair and some of the outfits. But I like Princess Leia. I like how she handles things. I like how she treats people. She tells the truth. She, you know, gets what she wants done. I don't have a real problem with Princess Leia. I've sort of melded with her over time.
You write in the book that you had endless issues with your appearance, how you looked in Star Wars.
Yes.
And you say, absolutely. What I saw in the mirror is not apparently what many teenage boys saw. So what did you see when you looked in the mirror?
A giant, fat face like a sand dab with features.
And the hair.
The horrible hair. I just looked like, I don't know, like this really fat-faced, cute, in a not a good way, girl.
Whose idea was it to have the buns on either side of your head?
Well, they kept putting hair on. They kept saying to me, you like this one. There were some worse ones, if you can imagine. But it was George and the producers. I mean, you know, Pat McDermott, the hairdresser, kept putting hairstyles on me. We kept parading them in front of them. And I don't know. They somehow chose that one. And to put more hair on either side of a round face is going to make it even wider. So that was my problem with that.
While we're speaking about appearance, in Return of the Jedi, when you are held captive by Jabba the Hutt, who is this like giant, slimy, slug-like creature and crime boss, and you're wearing this like incredibly revealing metal bikini. You are rail thin.
I know.
And you're wearing this like wearing. I mean, he has you chained, so there's this like big like metal chain around your neck. So it's a very like PG-13 kind of campy S&M B&D image.
Yeah.
And Jabba the Hutt is like licking his lips. He's stroking you. So there's something like so like sexual about it, but this is a movie for kids. So was there lots of joking on the set about like the deeper S&M imagery of this scene?
No. What my joke was, when we first rehearsed it, they're brought in front of Jabba. They talk to Jabba. Jabba talks to Harrison and Mark. And then they're led off. They never say, hey, how are you? So as they were being led off, I said in the rehearsal, don't worry about me. I'll be fine. Seriously. Which I thought they should have kept in there. Because it was like, where am I in all this? Sure, they're going to be digested for 2,000 years, but I have to stay with the slug with the big tongue.
And nearly naked.
Nearly naked, which is not a, you know, style choice for me.
We're listening to our 2016 interview with Carrie Fisher. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air.
Let's get back to our interview with Carrie Fisher, recorded in November 2016. She died 1 month later on December 27th. The following day, December 28th, her mother, Debbie Reynolds, died.
Your mother is Debbie Reynolds. You had a very contentious relationship with her when you were a teenager, and I think that probably continued into your 20s. And that, you know, you worked in her Broadway show. You were in the chorus of that. You sang in her Broadway act, you know, in her cabaret act for a while. So you worked together. In some ways, you were very close. In some ways, you were, like, very far apart. You were anxious to move away from home. How did your relationship change as she became an older woman? Like, when you became, like, now, like, you're middle-aged, she's, or older, she's in her 80s. Is the relationship still contentious? Has it changed?
Not at all. I can appreciate it. She's an immensely powerful woman, and I just admire my mother very much. She also annoys me sometimes when she's, you know, mad at the nurses. But, you know, she's an extraordinary woman. Extraordinary. There's very, very few women from her generation who worked like that, who just kept a career going all her life and raised children and had horrible relationships and lost all her money and got it back again. I mean, she's had an amazing life, and she's someone to admire.
Did you appreciate her strength and her accomplishments more as you got older?
Oh, God, yeah. No, when I was a kid, I just thought she was someone who was telling me what to do, and I didn't want to do it.
How did you feel about her celebrity when you were young? Was it helpful? Was it intrusive?
Well, I had to share her, and I didn't like that. When we went out, people sort of walked over me to get to her. And no, I didn't like it. I didn't like it. And, people thought that I overheard someone saying, well, she thinks she's so great because she's Debbie Reynolds' daughter. And I didn't like it. It made me different from other people, and I wanted to be the same. I wanted to be, you know, just no different than anybody else.
Your mother's most iconic film is Singin' in the Rain, you know, one of the great musicals of all time. What are your thoughts about the movie? And if you like it now, did you always, or did it take you a while to appreciate that film too?
No, I always liked it. It's brilliant. I mean, to do the transition from silent to sound is a brilliant, brilliant time to focus on. And what was interesting to me is that there's three people acting in the movie then. It's two men and a female, and the same with Star Wars. And both movies were sort of, iconic they did the AFI 10 top films, and one was Singing in the Rain and one was Star Wars.
That's so great. You were on the list together.
I know.
You write that you felt doomed to have bad relationships with men. That's what you'd seen. You know, Eddie Fisher, your father, walked out on your mother when you were two to be with Elizabeth Taylor. Your mother's second husband spent all of her money. I mean, left her with nothing.
Left her with nothing, and she had to pay his debts. So future earnings went to him. Everything she made went to his debts, to Harry Carl, who was also having sex with hookers the entire length of their relationship, which she found out later on, and so did we. So it was a very interesting childhood.
So when women dress like you at Comic-Con conventions, what do you most frequently see reflected back at you? Like, which costumes, which hairdos?
Oh, my favorite one to see is the metal bikini on men. And that is what has been happening a lot.
Yeah,
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot. And not thin men, by the way.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, so that makes me feel good about myself. kind of a before and after thing. This is way after. Not only is Princess Leia fatter, she's a guy.
All right. Carrie Fisher, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Carrie Fisher recorded in November 2016, 1 month before her death. Debbie Reynolds died 1 day after Fisher's death. Our End of the Decade series featuring staff picks from the decade continues through the end of next week. If you enjoy hearing interviews from the past, we have a great new archive site featuring Fresh Air interviews going back as early as the 1970s when Fresh Air was a local program in Philadelphia. You can search by name or topic. You can make playlists. Check it out at freshairarchive.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Teresa Madden directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Candida Fund, supporting individual dignity and sustainable communities through investments in transformative leaders and ideas. Learn more at kendedafund.org. And from Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device that adjusts insurance rates based on safe driving habits. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.